What episode is this? Episode 7?
Yeah.
Episode 7. Hooray. Welcome to episode 7 of Thinking Habits. This episode is brought to you by painkillers and lower back pain, which is one of the most uncomfortable things I've ever experienced. It's absolute torture today. But the show must go on and all that. It's fine, really. It's just uncomfortable. I'm here today with Pam again. Say hi, Pam.
Hello.
And we're doing another podcast at home. It came from a topic that we were talking about the other day, and it seems quite appropriate and apposite to talk about it this week because it's something that's been on our minds for quite a long time. And that topic is the idea of resetting and how that can be approached through work or through personal life. And it's something, like I said just before, it's become very relevant to us because of a variety of different things that are happening with us in business and our personal lives, that the idea of reset becomes quite important. So we started talking about this yesterday, the difference between what would be a soft reset and a hard reset, didn't we?
Yes, yeah. I think a soft reset is more of a something you should do regularly, like, you know, the end of every day. You have a time when you finish work and that's it, you leave it behind. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's probably the most common example that everyone can relate to. And in some jobs it's easier to do than others.
Yeah, I did that. I used to do that. It's an odd metaphor. I used to have a very specific ritual. When you work in a prison, it's airport security every day. So you have to take your shoes off, you have to take your belt off, you have to take any metal off, you're not allowed to bring your phone in, they x-ray everything. And then once you've gone through, you identify yourself with whatever security means they have. In this case, it was fingerprints or handprint scanners to get you through. I think it may be even in some prisons, it's like iris scanners and things like that now. But in order to get your keys, you identified yourself and you took your keys out of a secure locker. And those keys were held securely with these little tracker tokens, they're called. They look like bullets, but they kind of stick into this magnet thing that stops the keys from going out without being recorded. And what a lot of people did, and myself included, was because of the type of people that I was working with, it would be very easy to take that work home. And, I mean, you know as well as I do that, regardless of how many mantras and mottos I had,
yes,
I ended up taking it home anyway. But I used to try and leave all the shit attached to my keys and then leave the prison. And then I knew that when I picked up my keys the next day, I could carry those problems with me.
We're still talking metaphors.
We're still talking metaphors, not physical issues. Although, well, it depends which prisoners you're working with. But the idea of... Because at the end of the day, once I've left that environment, there is absolutely nothing I can do once I'm out of that door. I'm off shift. I can't get back in. There's other people taking over that role on a different shift. As long as I'm comfortable by the time I put my keys in, that anything that needs handing over has been handed over, and that I know that I've kept people safe and I know that I've kept myself safe, then I can leave. Then I can go. So for me, that was what a soft reset did for me. And I know your experience of working in different environments, you had different ways of doing that as well.
Yeah, and I think it's not, you know, and although you were doing what in a lot of ways was a much more high pressure, you were in a much more high pressure environment, I did envy that. Leave my keys, have my keys in, get my personal stuff back, get my phone back, get my keys back, and then it's that there was a very clear delineation because you couldn't do any once you'd gone through that security and out the doors, you couldn't do anything about
anything
until your next shift started.
Yeah,
and you couldn't. It was difficult to get in touch with anyone about anything.
Mm.
So, you know, you had that delineation. But I think it's if you're not in such a clear-cut situation, it is important to work out what that soft reset means to you. Mm. And it's something that I didn't always do.
No.
Well, it's something affect
that,
me.
It's something that didn't end up working for me either,
yeah.
Really.
I mean, yeah, obviously you can't take stuff out of your head.
No, it builds up over time, though. The problem is, if you've got an underlying anxiety or mental health problem, it makes it a lot worse. But
and I suppose having the not being able to do anything about it means that sometimes literally all you can do is stew about it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have got that, you know, email access or you can work on, if you know it's going to make you feel better to get something out of the way, you can do that. It's just that shouldn't be a regular habit.
No,
you should, I think you should have it so that mostly you can have that soft reset every day or every shift or every week.
I think, and also if you're supported to do that by the place you're working, it can definitely work.
Yeah.
I think the problem that I had, and I think it's something that was definitely echoed by other practitioners, was that we didn't get any support from the trust. The prison service were more supportive than the mental health trust we worked for, because we were, to a certain extent, isolated in there. They kind of forgot about us a little bit because we were behind four walls. But also, the senior management didn't really have any understanding of what we did.
Yeah.
So they didn't really understand the different types of pressure that we were under. And when it came to things like coroner's inquests, because anybody who dies in the prison has to undergo a coroner's inquest, regardless of whether it's natural causes, suicide, or by, you know, nefarious means. But I certainly felt in the one particular coroner's inquest that I was involved in, was that the Mental Health Trust didn't understand it and didn't support us in the way they should have done, and to a certain extent threw us under the bus because they didn't know how to deal with it. As it turned out, you know, the coroner's inquest in itself was largely straightforward. I mean, it was a cut and dried case. It was, you know, there was nothing came out of it really. But at the same time, when you're a brand new nurse and you're involved in this, you rely on your peers to help you get through that kind of thing, and we didn't get that kind of support. And that's when I started taking things home, because you can't leave that home.
No.
Because I waited for 2.5 years to go to coroner's court, and that's all I thought about for about two of those years.
Yeah, and I think it's something like, even sitting, like you say, it was something really straightforward in terms of that situation, in terms of an inquest.
Yeah.
If it's not something you've experienced before, then you've got that. Then there's that added anxiety to compound it. And I can't relate to it, because I think it's something you can only experience.
Well,
you know, even someone who's been through more, you know, been through several, just surely through the amount of time they've worked in that kind of environment.
Oh yeah, I mean, I know nurses who've done dozens.
Yeah,
so, they never get any easier.
No, but they'll still have, the only thing they have, the only advantage they've got is that they know the format it's going to take. You know, it's not the first time they've had to stand up. But
no.
I suppose every case must be different as well. So
it is, and they do.
So that's why they'll say it doesn't get any easier.
But I think with regards to the resetting and stuff, I think, you know, it's an interesting phrase, because you could use that again in those circumstances.
Yeah.
After the end of the inquest, we should have a debrief.
Yes.
By actual process, we should have a debrief.
Yes.
We never did.
No. Well, that's what's good. Having a debrief, and I think having, like, say the sort of support, then that helps you to empty the stuff out of your head that you can't leave behind.
No.
And sometimes just talking about it and being allowed to go through it in a methodical way while you're away from actually having to work on whatever it is, you know, you're in a safe space or whatever you want to call it, a one-to-one, or, you know, being able to just unpack your thoughts, it can help you reorder it, and you can go, well, okay, I can it's not as complicated as I thought it was, or it's actually I did do everything right, and I did everything right. It's just the outcome wasn't what we wanted, but maybe it couldn't be helped, or it would have been. It was down to a lot of different factors, a lot of which weren't your responsibility, and you're not the only person who is going to be having issues with this.
No, but I think regardless of the outcome of that, I mean, it's just a good example of what clinical supervision would do for you if you're in a stressful situation. Yeah. But any kind of, you know, when I'm struggling, if I'm struggling with my mental health, I'll ring you.
Yeah.
And I'll say, I'm having a bit of a bad day. You know, I need to unpack this. Can I just bounce something off you? And just the very act of having to vocalise things means that you start thinking about it differently. I've recorded a couple of episodes of this, and while I'm talking, I'm thinking, actually, this makes a bit more sense now, whereas it didn't before.
Yeah.
Because when you start to articulate it, it sounds different to how it does when it bounces around inside your head.
Yeah, I think sometimes as well, actually just saying it out loud, at the same time you're explaining or trying to explain, you start to think about how it is coming across, because saying stuff out loud is very different. You know, I have imaginary conversations all the time.
Oh yeah, but imaginary shower arguments.
Oh yeah, I'm brilliant at those. Yeah. And you know, you can replay stuff and replay, and I do. But actually, saying to someone, even if you're not expecting a response, you start to realise by forming the words, you start to realise how you can reorder it and you make sense of it, and you'll come to your own conclusion. And even if you went looking for some advice or looking for some reassurance on something, you talk yourself round to an answer. And you know, sometimes whoever you're talking to will be saying, well, I don't really know what the problem was, but I'm glad I helped. And
I've been on the receiving end of that before.
Yeah.
You know, people have rung me up and then kind of said something, and then said, thanks very much for that. And I've gone, well, I didn't actually say anything. I'll do anything.
Yeah.
But I think, again, you know, I think it's important to also note that can be very, very easy to do without thinking. But it's a lot easier to do when you're in a position where your mental health is good.
Yes, yeah.
When my anxiety's on tilt, I can talk myself into a downward spiral, and it doesn't matter how I word it or how I write it down or how I try and, you know, argue it out in the shower on my own, it still doesn't make any sense, and that's when you start needing a bit more help.
Yeah.
But again, I think that it brings us back to the idea of resetting. I think we reset in so many different ways in our lives, consciously or subconsciously, that I think it's almost resets a little bit too stark a word. It's almost just refocusing.
Yeah.
Where am I now? What am I doing? What's going on from here?
Yeah.
And I suppose that's where you could bring everything in from when you go and do yoga, or I go and do MMA, or we do mindfulness. You know, you stop and you go, right, here I am. This is what's going on. This is what's happening from here.
Yeah, I think mindfulness, it can be really good for that, because once I realised that you're not trying to switch your mind off, you're just observing.
You're observing the thoughts without
what you're worried about,
yeah,
but without going off down that path.
Mm.
And you know, there's a lot of terms that get used in business that you kind of roll your eyes at and say, okay, well, we're going to park that for now and move on. You know, that you roll your eyes because they almost come under the same bracket as the whole latest buzzword, and you know, people will take the piss out of them a bit. But when you actually look at what it means, you think, well, I'm going to park that, right, I'm leaving that, I'm going away from it for a bit.
Yeah.
It'll still be there when I get back.
Yeah.
And if it's not, and I think bullet journaling, recently looking into bullet journaling, can we put a link on that?
Yeah, I did it on episode one, so yeah, there's a link already on that one, yeah.
But that is worth looking at, and I'm not far enough into it to have got. I think there will still be benefits, but looking at and work, like working on like not task lists, but daily lists, and then looking at things that you might not have done it, but it's like actually it's not that relevant anymore.
Yeah.
Or you can say, well, I still want to do it, but it's not. It's not. There's other stuff that's more important, or it'll be much easier if I get them out of the way.
Yeah.
And then you can. I think it helps ordering your time more, because that's certainly something I need, and it adds into that coming back to resetting and refocusing. It. If you've made a note, I'm using sort of business terms, but if you've make it, it's not like if you've written it somewhere, or you've have a note on your phone, or a notebook works better for you, then you've made a statement that I haven't done it yet. I still want to do it. I haven't forgotten about it. I will get back to it.
You're marking your intent.
Yeah, it's a statement of intent that is going to happen, or you're going to attempt it. You know, you might not complete something, or it might not be possible. But it's not just bouncing around in your head and might get forgotten about.
Yeah,
because that's something that I struggled with without really realising I was struggling with it. I would be very good at keeping stuff in my head and not forgetting to do things, but then it gets to the point where there's so much that it just becomes noise, and it becomes very difficult to pick out what's important, and so it becomes all you think about. All you're thinking about is all the things you haven't done yet.
And I think something you talked about the other day when we were talking about anxiety and stress and stuff is that when you personally, when I'm reflecting on what you were saying, when you have a lot to do, when you try and remember it all, and then you try and remember it all, and you try and remember it all, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then you end up doing none of it and hiding under the duvet because it just becomes insurmountable and terrifying.
Yes.
So what you were saying about bullet journaling, it helps you to kind of demarcate things to make them a more bite-sized and manageable thing. Which is a kind of reset on its own, I suppose, because you can tackle it in an ordered way, can't you?
Yeah, because you can pick out which bits are important or assign importance to them, and it becomes much easier to see that something that you've been placing, because if you keep it all in your head, it becomes this. It's just this sea of stuff that hasn't been done yet, and it all becomes equally important because you've not done any of it. And it's like if you're looking at, I don't know, say tidying your house.
A sore subject at the moment because the house is a mess, isn't it?
Well, yeah, because we've both been so busy past few weeks. But it's something like, I don't know, rearranging a bookshelf is less important than emptying the dishwasher or washing the clothes, because the books have been sat in that order, or going through books to see which ones can go to charity or be given away. They've been sat there in that order for 6 months, a year. Another week isn't going to make any difference. If the dirty washing sits there for another week, that's going to make a massive difference, because we'll have another week's worth of dirty washing and no clothes to wear.
Yeah.
So, it's and that's a really obvious thing, but when you don't have an outlet for all the other tasks, then it becomes as muddy as not being able to choose between what's more important, sorting the bookshelf out or doing the washing.
Do you think that's that's something that you struggle with because you have anxiety and problems around that, or do you think it's just because that's something that can affect everyone in varying degrees?
I think there's a I think it's a bit of both. I think to a certain extent, it can affect everyone. But I also think it's something that I am particularly. Maybe it's the way my anxiety works. It's certainly something that triggers it in a big way, and I think that. It triggers it and it manifests in that way, not like panicking about not being able to fix a situation is another way that it manifests. Even if it's just something I'm observing and it's not my problem to fix, and no one thinks it's my problem to fix, but if I can't do something to at least help make it a bit better, then I feel really bad about that.
And you take on that responsibility.
I take it on, and it was something that was never meant to be my responsibility. And if I could offer some help, people would be maybe surprised and grateful, or it might be unwelcome. But
have you got an example?
I'm trying to think of something, but it could be something like someone else unpacking something that has happened to them at work, or a problem they've got at work, or something that and like if you're wanting to bounce ideas off me, or not bounce ideas, but just saying, oh, I've got this issue, or task that's been ongoing and I'm waiting for other people, or whatever, and I don't know what it is that you're doing, but you're not expecting me to be able to help. Want to talk to someone about it.
Exactly.
But I'm thinking, my mind immediately starts going, well, what can I do to make it better? How can I help? And it's like, I can't help physically. I can't come and do some of the work for you.
No, I know.
Or give you the answers that you're waiting for from other people.
I wouldn't expect you to. I think it's a lot of that is, I think that's just because you're a very empathetic person.
Yeah.
And I think that it comes from that. I know exactly what you mean. You kind of almost project a responsibility to make things better.
Yes.
For the people that you care about, you know. I mean, I sometimes do it at work, but to a far less degree. I'd love to be able to help people out with things I don't really understand.
Yeah.
But like you say, sometimes all you can do is be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's great, because when I come home and I moan at you about what's been going on at work, God forbid I would ever try and explain to you some of the idiosyncrasies of the stuff that I do. One, because it's incredibly dull when you actually unpick it, and two, I don't talk to you for that.
No.
I don't need you to understand what I do any more than I understand the stuff you're doing when you're doing all your financial accounting and stuff. But when you tell me the things that are annoying you about that, I know I can't help.
Yeah,
balance the books or whatever, but I can help you by being the person that takes the burden off you for a little while, while you sort your head out. And I think that can be just as useful, if not more useful, than actually wading in and taking it off you. For the record, I will never understand accounts the way you do. I do not get it. When you started doing the books and stuff for us, I was just so glad, because my brain does not work that way, and it just fills me with anxiety. It really does. And I think that, but then, going back to the whole reset theme, if you're resetting, you also need to know your limits. You can't be everything to everybody. And I think that sometimes when you're in a position where we were talking about getting into a cycle where you end up living to work rather than working to live, you sometimes end up trying to be everything to everybody.
Yes.
Because you take on too much responsibility, plus this overwhelming need to please everyone, and then all of a sudden you by default start becoming everything to everybody because of this abstract and perverse sense of responsibility that's come out of nowhere.
And then you end up not doing anything. You end up with so much that you're not doing any of it very well.
No.
And then you run into more problems, and the whole thing just snowballs and gets out of control. And I think because there's so much going on, you won't notice that creeping up.
No.
And you know that's when I think that's when it becomes time for what we coined a hard reset.
Yeah.
And that can be a choice or not a choice. You know, so and there's, you know, everyone can relate to looking at another person's situation, and you know whether that be a work situation or a change in their working life or change in relationship status or financial status or working like a sudden redundancy or a sudden illness and go, I couldn't cope with that, I don't know how they could. And it's like, but I bet if you'd asked them 6 months ago, they wouldn't have thought they could cope with it. And you just manage. And sometimes you will seem like you will... There will be not coping at all, but you're still living in it. And it's... And you know, you might look at someone and think, God, they're coping really, really well, and I don't know how they're doing it. But on the inside or behind closed doors, they really don't think they don't see it that way at all. They just say, but because they're still functioning, everyone else thinks
it's like the swan, isn't it?
They're managing really well.
It's like the swan. It's you're dead settled on the top of the water, and the feet are kicking underneath.
But that can be dangerous as well, because it's like trying to project. You spend so much trying to project this outward. Everything's great. I'm managing. I'm dealing with all this, and it can take. This hard reset, there's the initial change in circumstances, but then you've got to coming to terms with it can take a really long time, and it's you don't realise it until something else, it'll take something to make you notice it, or maybe someone you've not seen for a long time, you bump into them again and they say, you know, you're so much different, you're so much better than when I saw you 12 months ago or when I saw you 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know, you're so much more like I remember from when we first met or something.
Sounds like you're reflecting on the position that you found yourself in a couple of years ago, where you left an incredibly stressful job.
Yes.
Which was having detrimental effects on your physical and mental health. Because I certainly noticed, you know, in the period of sort of a year to 18 months after that, and that was, like you say, an enforced hard reset, as it was. But that forced you to reevaluate what was important, didn't it? And you had a certain period of introspection, but then you were able to sort of rebuild at a level and at a pace that suited you. And I think that was very valuable for you.
It was very valuable. I mean, I did have the advantage that. You know, there were certain pressures that could be removed from that. Like, you were able to help financially, and not everyone has that. And I do acknowledge that was one less thing to worry about. Obviously, things changed.
Yeah.
But it wasn't oh my God, we might not have anywhere to live. You know, it wasn't.
But that doesn't stop us knowing the kind of people that we are, and the fact that we default to maximum anxiety every single time
and catastrophize it all.
Yeah, that does crop into your mind.
Yeah,
because you go from everything's fine to everything's dreadful almost immediately.
Yes.
You know, I do that. On the most trivial of things.
And,
so
you know, I'm not the first person to have gone through that, even in that specific set of circumstances. I'm not the first person to have gone through it, and I won't be the last.
No.
But it was still a new situation for me.
Yeah.
And having an enforced hard reset made. In some, you know, it made it possible to have a lot, because you talked about me having a period of introspection, which I definitely did, and not all of it good, but it enabled me to have resets in other areas. Like I was fortunate enough to be able to take a step back and go, well, okay, what do I really want to do? Do I want to find, do I want more of the same? Do I want to carry on down this path of working, you know,
working for the man, man.
Well, no, but work, yeah, working in a finance role and a management role. Do I want to pursue that? Do I still want what I wanted 5 years ago when I started in this role? And it was the path I'd been following for a long time. Is that still what is going to make me happy?
I think, or what was most interesting for me that came out of that was that there was something you said to me about six months down that road, was that you never intended to end up doing that. You just ended up doing it. And I think that's what sometimes happens with, I can identify with that, in that I've kind of blundered my way through different roles and found myself in different situations just by happenstance. And I think it's interesting when you are forced into a situation where you have to start again or in some or all of aspects of your life and career, you look back on it and you think, how the hell did I end up here in the first place?
Yeah.
And that was really interesting to me, because I thought that was, I kind of thought that was just me that kind of bumbled through. But it seems that it's happened to both of us, and I think it's a lot more common than either of us gave it credit for.
And I think I think there's, you know, even when I was at school, there were people who said, there were people who had a very specific career path in mind, and, you know, there was a boy in my class who, he was in my class right from first year high school, and he always said he was going to be a doctor.
Oh yeah, and he told me about him.
Yeah, and he's now a surgeon.
Yeah,
and he followed that path. And there's like your friend who wanted to be a journalist.
Oh, Simon, yeah. His dream from being a kid was he wanted to be a football commentator. And I remember him telling me that when we were 11 years old. He said, one day I'm going to do that. And he did it for a while. I mean, he did it for like 2 or 3 years. He ended up hating it. But, yeah.
But he did it.
You know, he got that. He followed that to its logical conclusion.
Yeah.
And sometimes people find that route and then realise that actually it's not what I thought, you know, it's not what I built it up to be. It's yeah, something else.
But, you know, there are people who have a set career path. So they know, so from that they know what choices they need to make when it comes to GCSEs and A levels, and so that they know what degree they need to have.
Yeah.
So they work backwards and go, well, okay, what A levels do I need to get into that degree? What GCSE options are going to set me up with the best foundation for those A levels? Yeah. And they can be that organised about it. Where there's other people, I kind of fell into, you know, I liked art. I was good at art, but because I was in top classes for academic subjects, it was always sort of sold to me that it's like, well, going into doing arty subjects, it's a bit wishy-washy, and there's not really much career out of, you know, you should be doing the more academic type A levels,
yeah.
And I was on a bit of a conveyor belt, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do with it, and I changed my mind several times coming into A levels, and I changed subjects, and didn't like the college I was at, and I wasn't in a very good place mentally, although I didn't really realise it at the time.
I think our generation were forced down a route.
Yeah, and there was
necessarily that we didn't necessarily want to do.
Something I wasn't prepared for, which a lot of people have said to me, not just agreeing with me, but have said to me, and then I've agreed with them, is that you don't even if you find GCSE level work easy, it's a massive step up for A levels that you're really not prepared for.
God.
And I think maybe the way they do it now, where they break it down, so you do an AS, you do AS in the first year, and then maybe that's smoothed the transition a little bit more. But I was not prepared for that, because I got through GCSEs without doing much work at all, and then A levels, I found suddenly you're expected to concentrate a lot more. it was a lot more difficult. It was a much higher level you're working at, so you couldn't just absorb the information. You were having to study it in a repetitive manner, which I can't do. My mind just doesn't work like that.
No,
I have to have. I can, you know, there's bite-sized chunks of information I can do really well, and I might, that'll spark my interest and I'll go off elsewhere.
Yeah,
maths doesn't work like that.
No,
not A level maths anyway.
I did all right. I did well in GCSE maths, and I thought, actually, do you know what? I actually quite liked maths GCSE.
Yeah.
And so I thought, oh, I'll do A level maths, because I had designs on being an architect for a little while, until I realised that it involved study, yeah, concentration, and focus, none of which I had in any capacity when I was about 16.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the jump between GCSE maths and A-level maths was like getting off a bike and being put in a fighter jet and then just going, crack on.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was dreadful. I think I got, in the lower six summer exam, I got the lowest mark in the entire year, and I think that was because I spelt my name right, and beyond that, nothing else. I was
it's like being awful. Put in a fighter jet, and you're given a manual in ancient Aramaic.
In Finnish, yeah.
So you've got 10 minutes with that, and then we're good
on
to go, yeah?
Yeah.
We've kind of wandered off topic a little bit, haven't we?
No, but I think it's valid, because we're talking about the fact that, you know, when you do stop and to smell the roses and actually work out where you are, sometimes you need to work out where you are, because you don't know how you got there in the first place.
Yeah.
And how do you work out where you want to be if you don't know where you've come from?
Or where you are.
And I think from my experience was, you know, I had an unpleasant week about 14 years ago, when I lost my job and my relationship broke down in the same week, within 24 hours of each other. So I was in a position where my reset was very much forced, and it was very stark. And you know, it took me a couple of weeks to even sort of get my head back above water and go, what the fuck is going on?
I mean, some of it was your choice or your agreement.
Well, yeah.
But even so, it's still...
Yeah, but
it's still a massive.
But the end game was that my slate was wiped completely clean.
Yeah.
From the point of view that a week before that, I kind of had a course, whether I was happy with that course.
Oh yeah.
Plotted out for me, and then all of a sudden, and it was really weird, because it took me. I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified, because I said to our friend Joe, I said, I've got nothing. I've got absolutely nothing. I don't know what to do. I've got nothing. And then about 2 days later, I realised that because I've got absolutely nothing, I've got no ties, I've got no responsibilities at the moment. I can literally do whatever I want. I can completely reinvent myself and go off and do something else. And I went from IT service work to going into healthcare.
Yeah.
That's what got me into nursing, and that's what got me, you know, to where I am, ironically, back in IT. But that was terrifying.
Yeah.
But when I realised that that can be, as scary as it is, incredibly powerful and incredibly valuable to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think once you get over the initial shock, because even if it is your own choice, it's still stepping. Even if you've made the choice to step off that cliff, you've still got to hit the ground, to talk in metaphors. But I'm gonna run with this metaphor.
Go for it. Go for it. I can see where you're going with it. I'm on board.
Exhilaration of the free fall. Once your mind gets past the initial. Once you've got past being terrified beyond the capacity for rational thought.
Deep cut there. Lovely.
Once you've got past that, you kind of go, oh, this is great. Or, you know, not great, but it's better than being terrified out of your mind.
Yeah.
And you start to go, and the a forced hard reset makes you, can make you count your blessings. But then yeah, you get to reinvent some or all of your life, and take the time to, you know, and sometimes the one thing you've got is time on your hands, and you can think about how you want to fill that time, and then look at ways that you can support yourself. You know, it's not, we're not talking about being a millionaire or anything, but you can, you know, you can find ways that you can make that, make that lifestyle work for you, and
absolutely,
and so you can end up so that you're working to live and you're enjoying what you're doing.
Yeah, what was it? What is it they say? You, if you find the job you love, you'll never work a day in your life. I mean, that it's a clunky metaphor, but
and it's, I think,
and it's usually said by incredibly wealthy people, which which is annoying. But
and recruiters.
Recruiters.
And it's
like,
well, I doubt any. You know, and it's usually the type of recruiter who's, who don't have the sort of job that is gonna make you feel like you're never working a day.
No, absolutely. But in my experience, apologies to any recruiters that I do know, a lot of recruiters are in league with Satan.
Yes.
Satan himself. Recruiters. I don't know how recruiters and estate agents are the most troublesome people that I've ever had to involve myself in. I'm probably going to cut this out because I'm probably offended a large proportion of people, but you know, you have to speak from experience. So, you know, I mean, one of the reasons why we're talking about resetting is because I'm in a position where I kind of want to, don't I? I think I'm in a position now where I'm getting a bit antsy. I'm getting a bit kind of. I'm excited about the things that we're doing. You know, this podcast is something I've always wanted to do, and you know, while it's never going to be, you know, a world beater, or you know, it's not a money spinning exercise. It's very much a cathartic self therapy exercise for me. But what it has really made me think is that you know, if you want to do something and you start things, good things come of it. You know, I'm 7 episodes into this, and all of a sudden people want to talk on the podcast. People have, you know, people are messaging and saying, here's a story that I'd like to tell, and here's something that I'd like to contribute. And, you know, I think it's, there's enough out there for everybody. But I think it's, I'm bored in my current job. I don't particularly like my current job as much as I used to. And that's nothing, you know, that's nothing against my colleagues who are wonderful, but I don't feel like I'm in a position where I'm enjoying my work-life balance enough, and I think I need to make some changes there. And I think I'm wondering whether or not I'm in a position where I should be looking at doing a hard reset. And I suppose putting my wife on the spot on a podcast and saying, can I do that, is a bit mean, but I think no, it's nothing we've not discussed before. But I think we're in a position where we're of the same mind, in that I think there's I think we're less frightened than we used to be of taking risks in terms of doing new things, aren't we?
Yes, we are, and I think we've got it's not a blind, if we were to make a change, it's not completely blindly, you know, it's there is an opportunity. Do you want to talk about other businesses?
Yeah, let's talk about the brewery.
Having those people who know us will know that we've been starting a brewery over the past, well, 2 years. We were two on Friday, but it's making the step from being a fun little nano brewery that does great beers for festivals, but doesn't make any money.
No,
not even. It's not even a paying hobby.
No, it pays for itself in the sense that the money we make from selling our beer enables us to make more beer and nothing more really at the moment.
Yeah, everyone still needs jobs. It's, you know, do we bite the bullet and then take the risk of going, well, let's stay like this, or we can actually try and make it something. And it's a lot easier to look at it that way when you've just had a really successful beer festival.
Yeah. I mean, Manchester Beer Week was on yesterday, and it was fun. We got to meet a lot of brewers, and we got to meet a lot of
I've been to a few events and spoken to quite a few people, and it's nice to know that something you do is well thought of. And, you know, we've had some constructive criticism feedback as well. And I do need to say this: there has been, because it's been myself and Erin at the front line.
Mm.
There's been a fair bit of mansplaining.
Oh, to us. Really?
But you know, it's
even yesterday.
Yeah.
You got mansplaining? I didn't notice that yesterday. But, well, I didn't stay all night because my back was bad and I had to bail early.
No, there was a bit of... And the thing is, when it's that kind of crowd, there's people always want to give you tips about... Because, you know, there's a lot of very enthusiastic homebrewers and people who know a lot, even if they don't brew at all, they know a lot about ale and probably know a lot more about beer than I do, simply through having an interest in different types of... And so they'll want to, and everyone has their own taste as well.
Yes.
So they'll be putting their perspective on it.
Of course they will.
Going, I like that, but it could have more of this, or and it's, you know, it's just taking that as an opinion rather than going, well, actually, that's not what we were aiming for. But
no.
And if you want that, go and buy it from someone else.
Someone else, yeah.
But obviously, that's not going to win you any customers.
No, absolutely. I mean, keeping it on topic.
Yeah.
What do you know, with the brewery being two, I think for me, the brewery has been a really good soft reset for me, because it is completely polar opposite to everything else that I do for a living. And I think it's really good, and it's really important to have something that is completely different. You know, it's like I go to MMA, I do my origami, we do the brewery. They're completely different from work. How do you find that the brewery's affected or helped your mental health?
I think it's been good, because it's shown me that you can have a meaningful career, I suppose. You can do something that having a 9-to-5 isn't the be all and end all, and you can build something yourself. And it doesn't have to be that something that other people do. It's made me think about, because I've always been quite guilty of seeing things that look nice, you know, or maybe experiencing something and go, oh, I wish I worked in something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not for me, that's for other people. And then it's made me kind of go, well, why not for me?
No.
You know?
Why can't I?
I mean, I've come to terms with, I've come to terms with the fact that I'm never going to be a ballerina, a prima ballerina. I think at nearly 38, I've had to accept that isn't going to happen, probably.
Well, you can, you know. Don't rule it out altogether.
No, but, you know, it's... There'd be a lot of work to put in, but that's probably not going to happen for me.
Mm.
I suppose it's the same as... similar to when, like, my brother realising that he maybe isn't going to be playing centre-forward for England in the World Cup now that he's 35.
Yeah.
He might have had, or he's not going to be a Premier League, he's not going to break in as a Premier League footballer now. It's probably gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's certain exceptions. But then with that, you know, you say never rule it out. So that, you know, something like running or playing a part in running a brewery, why not?
Yeah.
You know, it's, we've, over the past 2 years, we've proved that people like what we do. We've proved that it's possible to do that on not very much initial investment.
On a tiny budget.
Tiny budget. Albeit there's been a lot of support we've had and a lot of favours, but it also seems to be that kind of community. There's a really good microbrewery community in Manchester who are based around similar areas and who do help each other out with stuff.
But I think you could extrapolate that to Manchester as a whole. Where if you have a passion for anything in Manchester, that's why when I moved to this city when we first got together, I fell in love with this city, and I can't honestly see myself living anywhere else, because the sense of community in Manchester is absolutely incredible. And I think if you've got a passion for something and you are prepared to put the hard yards in, you will meet a group of like-minded people in Manchester who will work with you and alongside you to achieve that goal. And we've seen so many people start from modest beginnings and actually achieve their goal of starting a shop or a restaurant or a business or a clothing line or something like that, just by reaching out to a group of like-minded people and saying, look, what do you think of this? Do you think we can make a go of it?
Yeah, and I think there is also an attitude of, I think people can say, it's the stereotype of like the chippy northerner, but there is a kind of, well, if it doesn't work, I'll do something else.
Yeah.
And there's always a way out of it if you've got the right people around you, and I think that that sense of community that's really important. But you will, not letting your fear of failure or not succeeding scare you off from doing it in the first place. And that can be applied at all, that you can apply it on a really small level of, sometimes when I'm really, if I'm supposed to go to something, like last week going to Manchester Beer Week events, like when I went to the diversity and the Everyone's Welcome initiative, I went to that on my own, and I walked in to Fairfield Social Club and I didn't see it. I saw faces that I recognised, but no one that I knew well enough to go and say hi to, really. They were just faces that I'd seen at things and may or may not have thought the same about me, might not recognise me at all. And everyone had gone there with someone. I couldn't see anyone else who'd gone on their own. So I was thinking, and it was quite close to the start, although one of the speakers had been delayed. So it did actually end up, but I got there quite close to the start, the scheduled start time. So I got myself a drink and I sat down at one of the tables. And then when the talk started, I thought, I got really into it, and it just...
Pass me the pen.
When the talk started, it was really good, and a lot came out of it. And then they obviously said, I hope we'll stay and socialise afterwards and continue discussions, because obviously there'd be ideas that people might not have thought about straight away in the Q&A section. And I thought at that point my options were leave quietly.
Yeah.
Or make myself, or stay, get another drink and talk to people. And the anxious side of me that hadn't wanted to go in the first place, because I knew I was going on my own, the anxious part of me was going, well, you've seen the talk, which is what you came for. You've got a lot to take away from it. You can go now.
Yeah.
But then the part of me, then there was part of me thinking, but then you'll be thinking, oh, I wish I'd stayed. So I got a drink and I sort of stood at the bar and thought, well, there's people coming and going from here, so I can get into a conversation. And I stood there for a bit on my own, thinking, how do people start conversations? What do you do? Mm. And then I saw someone I recognised.
Yeah.
So I made myself go and say hello, and it was.
That's a massive big deal for you, because your social anxiety is pretty heavy sometimes.
Yes.
Isn't it?
It has stopped me doing stuff in the past, and being in a room full of people who seem to know each other when I don't really know anyone. Mm. Well, that is a massive trigger for my.
That's intimidating for anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But for me, it can render me speechless. I can be, even going and ordering a drink, I'll be stumbling over because I'm so anxious about being in a space where I feel like I'm the only person who doesn't know anyone.
Yeah.
And there's probably plenty, looking at it rationally, there's probably plenty of people who are there with maybe, even if they only know one or two people,
yeah,
they're thinking, I'm supposed to be here networking, or I'm supposed to connect with that person, or but when you're actually rationally, I know that, but actually being in that situation, it just makes me freeze up completely.
Mm.
And you know, I remember messaging you and going, oh, I've just spoken to so and so, and I actually made myself go into a conversation, and I did actually say, hi, I'm sorry, I hope you don't mind if I butt in, but I'm kind of making myself do this, and I hope you don't mind me just butting into your conversation.
And I bet they were absolutely fine.
They were absolutely fine, and from there I ended up talking to other people, because other people were doing the same thing, like overhearing a snippet and going, oh, I know about that. And and I think that won't be the last time that happens to me.
No.
And it will be something it probably be something that I have to keep working at. But then, you know, serving people over the bar yesterday, sometimes when it was quiet, I was getting into conversations with people. Now, admittedly, these were people who had been drinking for a couple of hours, and so were probably more chatty.
Yeah.
But it's
an interesting scenario being on that side of the bar, though, because I've found certainly that it's quite a powerful place to be when you're behind the bar, especially when people want to drink the beer that you're making.
Yeah, because you can refuse to serve them, and you're kind of obligated to refuse to serve them if they're
too drunk. Quite where I was going. I mean, it's more the fact that they want to hear what you've got to say.
Yes.
And they're the ones that will approach you and start the conversation.
Yeah.
So rather than you having to go up to somebody and say, you know, do you mind if I butt in, they're coming to you and saying, oh, what's in this? And obviously you know that because you made it. So it's
going back to my mansplaining comment earlier.
Oh God, yeah.
There was a group of friends came to the bar, and there was a guy who was ordering, and I think his girlfriend or his wife was next to it, and he said, this was after you'd left, and it was just me and Erin there, and I was doing the till bit, and Erin was doing the serving. And he said, so who makes your beer? And Erin was like, we do. It's me and Pam actually have been doing all the brewing at the moment. And he was like, really? And
but your girls.
Yeah, he went, really? You two do it all? I've made this. And she was like, yeah. And he was about the same age as us.
Yeah.
Probably a bit younger. And I could see the girl with him kind of giving him a bit of side eye. And we laughed and went, yeah, we make it. And he went, oh, he said, yeah, good for you. Because, you know, normally brewing's quite a manly thing, isn't it? And I could see her rolling her eyes, and he went, no, right. But it's, you know, it's more like, you don't see that many women, it's more a manly thing because, you know, it's men, you think of men drinking beer. And
keep digging, mate.
Yeah, and she was right, and she's just, in the end, she just went, just get the drinks and let's get. I like to think she said, you know, what was that?
Yeah.
But it was, you know. I think he realised what he was doing, he was saying, and then tried to dig him out of it, himself out of it, and made it worse, which people do.
I've never done that.
No. I mean, hopefully, you know, if he goes to another bar with female, another beer festival with female brewers, because there were plenty there yesterday.
He'll reflect on that and go,
maybe I shouldn't be so surprised.
No, he'll lean in and go, I've seen some of you people before,
yeah.
Women and that, brewing.
Yeah.
Frightening.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, but again, you know, circling back to the topic, because
yes,
although it does really seem like we've gone a bit off topic, it does, for me, it's all relevant because all this has all come from resetting, whether you want to or whether you know it's forced upon you. We found ourselves in a position where we're doing something completely different. If you'd have told me 8 years ago or 9 years ago that I'd end up working in a Category A prison, I'd have laughed openly in your face. I had no idea from that was going to happen. Yeah. I just didn't, you know,
even though you were already on your path to nursing,
yeah.
At that point, you'd have been
that,
midway through qualifying.
Yeah, I had no idea that that's where I'd end up. And then you tell me, you know, five years ago, that we'd have started a microbrewery for shits and giggles just to see what happens, and we'd end up, you know,
considering making it a
going concern. And I'd be just like, what, you know, because you don't end
are
up
are you on drugs?
Yeah, you don't know where you're going to end up. And I think the power of being able to reset from the point of view of your personal life and your mental health and your physical health is incredibly powerful, in that it reminds you that you should never limit yourself to what you believe your life is destined for you. Mm. Because a lot of people will work on that they have a destiny. You know, you see all these programs about people going on, you know, on these singing programs, and they believe it's their destiny to become the next Beyonce or whatever. And some people consider that a pipe dream. Some people consider that arrogant. But at the same time, some people would consider that admirable, that they've gone and chased that dream because they believe it's their destiny. I don't particularly have anything that I believe is my destiny.
No.
But at the same time, I believe that I think if you put your mind to something that you really enjoy, you can achieve it. And I think that's quite an exciting place to be.
I remember the cards that I bought at very first beer festival.
Oh, yeah.
That I meant to take with me yesterday, actually, to put on the bar. Never give up on your stupid dreams.
Yeah, that's. Yeah, I remember because we bought that at the Left Bank Beer Festival.
Yeah, it was in the card shop.
Yeah, that's upstairs, actually,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's framed. It's framed. I meant to take it with me.
Yeah, and I think that's an appropriate place to pause this episode. I think it's been a little bit of a stream of consciousness, this one, because I think it's something that a conversation that we had while walking around town about the power of starting again, whether that's temporarily or permanently or in a small scale or a large scale. And I think
and walking to set up
yeah,
beer festival, which was kind of the, not the culmination, but it's certainly what we've been working towards as a short term goal, being that one of the organisers of a brand new beer festival.
Yeah.
So it prompted a bit of reflection.
Yeah. As to where we are now and where
and what has got us there, and situations that you can think are catastrophic, you can build, so you can, you know, not to get too flowery about it, but good can come of it, and you can build something
positive
from it. You can take positives from the situation.
Yeah.
And build something from that.
Yeah.
And that's where I think that is what prompted
the idea
how you define those changes and came up with resetting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it can, as frightening as it can be, I think it can, as long as you take things steady and you get the right support, I think you can achieve pretty much whatever you want to, can't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's pause there, because I think I think we've gone on for long enough, but I think there's quite a lot to unpick there. I think there's, to be honest, there's quite a lot to cut out as well. So I'll have have a look at that. But
yeah, I'm quite impressed. My voice has held out.
Yeah, mine too. I hope you enjoyed that. And please, again, feedback welcome, because you know these are always supposed to be conversation starters. You know, it's not the be all and end all of any topic. What we'd like to do is just get these things out there and have you chip in, because that's the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it would be something quite interesting to revisit, maybe when, if there's any feedback.
Mm. Have you ever reset? Have you ever started again? Do you want to? Do you have any machinations on sort of reinventing yourself, doing something else? Do you have a dream you've always wanted to pursue? I think if it can be absolutely terrifying and exciting in equal measure, and I think if that's anything, if that's what we take away from this, I think that can only be a good thing, can't it?
So, yes.
In the meantime, you know what to do. Keep talking, and if you need to talk, you know where we are. Bye.
Bye.